You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. I'm Karen Shook, Books Editor, and today my guest is Trevor Cox, Professor of Acoustic Engineering at the University of Salford, President of the Institute of Acoustics, and author of a fantastic new book, probably an object lesson in a sharply written popular science book, Sonic Wonderland, A Scientific Odyssey of Sound. Thanks for joining me, Trevor.
It's a great pleasure.
So Sonic Wonderland starts with a descent into a dark and smelly place, not the REF, but a London sewer, goes through an oil storage complex at Inchindown in Scotland, the great Stalag pipe organ in a cave in Virginia, bursting balloons at Stonehenge, creeping into a Neolithic chamber, the Whispering Gallery at St. Paul's, squeaking sands, musical roads, annoying and beautiful bird songs, ducks with non-echoing quacks, supposedly, John Cage, an anechoic chamber, and wind-driven musical instruments in the Lake District. You racked up a few miles here, it sounds like.
Yeah, I did, actually. I've just done my tax return for this year and realized how much I spent racking up those many miles. It was really, you know, that was a delight, really a good excuse. I think as academic, you tend to sort of kind of get stuck in your area, getting more and more narrow in what you look at. But to have an excuse to go, okay, let me just look across any area of acoustics that I find interesting was really, you know, quite a privilege, really.
Now, your 2004 book, Acoustic Absorbers and Diffusers, your 2014 book, Sonic Wonderland, slight difference in focus, in reach, and indeed, I assume, in tone. I think everyone who's written a book, and obviously Acoustic Absorbers and Diffusers is now in subsequent editions and has been acclaimed, but this is a completely different kettle of fish, and not every scholar makes the leap between one or the other. Do you think everyone hopes they've got a Sonic Wonderland in them?
I don't know. Most academics I talk to, when I say I'm writing a book, kind of assume it's an academic text like Acoustic Absorbers and Diffusers, which, as we all know, anyone who's done this, you know, you sweat blood over and then you don't sell very many copies, even if it's successful, and you'd be better off financially flipping burgers in McDonald's. So, you know, we do those because we you know, we love the subject. But the idea behind Sonic Wonderland is to reach out beyond my peer group, beyond the people who are in the industry doing acoustics, beyond those researchers, to people, just everyday person in the street. I wanted to write a book that people would sit down on the beach at the summer and read and enjoy.
Now, it sounds like a radio or TV series waiting to happen, to be honest. Do you think that's because of your background in radio documentaries and just understanding what captures people's attention? The fact that, for example, you've got words to paint a picture about sound, to mix a lot of metaphors?
Yes, I think a lot of it came from my radio work. So I was really lucky. I had an EPSRC Senior Media Fellowship. And with a lot of that time, I did a lot of radio documentaries and learned lots about communicating to the public because it's just so very different to talking to your peer group. In fact, I find going to academic conferences quite painful now, sitting through the very poorly presented papers I have to watch, which all got great science in, but I think, God, couldn't they just present that a bit better? I think that gave me a lot of experience of talking to people in radio and understanding what works and what doesn't, working with some great producers. And the kind of the next step seemed obvious to me was to try and write something. And it's quite hard getting sound stuff onto television because people work in television
probably
assume it should be on radio. so I thought I'd try my hand at writing instead. And it's been a real long, long learning curve. This was not the first idea for a book.
Right.
Actually getting even an idea, you know, actually approved by both an agent and then a publisher is hard work. And then actually writing it, it's just a really different form. You know, the thing is, when you write an academic book or you write an academic paper, if it's in the field and someone needs to know it, they will plough their way through it, however badly written it is, until they understand it. Whereas if someone's sitting down at home reading Sonic Wonderland and they decide they are not interested in this, it's boring, they'll put it down and they won't pick it up and you've lost the reader forever.
It really seems like a lot of work went into the shaping of the book, the thinking about the narrative, and indeed the sense of the personality of the author. Obviously, that can come across in radio work. We all know academics whose work is enormously acclaimed and who may be fairly dry on paper, but when you speak to them, there's a charm in even the most, you know, intimidating quantum physicist that comes across in their voice. But it's not so easy to get that on paper. And to what extent is there a fear that if you come across as a blokey everyman or someone who's happy to admit that he embarrasses his family by clapping in a stairwell at a museum or feels awkward at a Buddhist retreat, that does kind of go against the gravitas that a scholar attempts to put across elsewhere. I mean, if you look too goofy, people aren't going to believe you know what you're talking about when it comes to acoustics. So there is a shift there, it seems to me, in how you need to come across generally as a professional and then how you need to seem sympathetic in a book like this. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think there's something, I think one thing I've done is that I'm doing this relatively, I say late in career, I'm not that old, but, you know, I'm a professor. I've been.
No, you're youthful.
I got one review said a boyish enthusiasm, which I think I'll have framed and put on my wall.
Well, there's a very boyish picture at the back of the book, so there's either some retouching going on or you genuinely are an early career scholar.
Well, anyway, I'm mid-40s for those who don't know me. Anyway, I think, you know, I've done my time in getting research grants in and publishing papers and having myself submitted to the ref, that people don't doubt my science. And I think if I was doing this from the beginning, if I'd been a young postdoc doing this kind of stuff, I think, yes, there would be more risk that people would see you as being frivolous.
Right.
But as people are using my research text to design concert halls, they know that behind this kind of fun is someone who's quite, you know, is quite serious. But, yeah, I think there's a fine line to tread. I do remember my previous VC hating a particular piece in the Times Higher when I got the world record for the largest whoopee cushion in the world, and in the Times Higher, I didn't expect it. There was a picture of me lying down on top of it, and my previous VC was definitely not chuffed.
Then again, as you and I know, the focus on public engagement is only on the rise at universities. We get endless press releases every week that attempt to do the same thing as convey some interesting point about the biggest whoopee cushion in the world, or that search to find out whether ducks' quacks really do echo or not, or the most horrible sound in the world. We often get much less engaging versions of those in press releases. So maybe your previous VC was quite old school, but it does seem to us at the media end that there's more and more requirement to do that sort of thing by academics, or at least to have someone take their research and turn it into a press release that focuses on whoopee cushions or forces you to lie on top of one for a picture.
There's a generational difference, I think. I think from my experience of talking to people who have harumphed a little bit, they tend to be of the older school, not all of them. And I think there's also a sort of personality difference as well. There's some people who are more staid and more introverted and more, you know, less extrovert themselves. I don't know if I'm an extrovert really, but I'm prepared to do extrovert things for publicising science. So there's some difference in different people's attitude. There's people who would never do anything like it, and there's people who kind of really appreciate it. But I think when you think about public engagement, the easy bit is to write a nice article for New Scientist. Actually, it's not easy, but, you know, or the easy bit is to get a nice press release, which then gets a nice article in The Telegraph.
Yeah.
You know, that's talking to your peer group largely. You know, when I'm on Radio 4, I love doing Radio 4, but all my colleagues I know listen to Radio 4 because everyone comments on it. All my friends comment on it.
Absolutely.
The difficult thing in public engagement is getting to the groups who aren't listening to Radio 4, who aren't reading The New Scientist. And you're not going to be able to communicate the same, it's not quite gravitas, but you're not going to be able to get into the same intellectual detail. You're going to have to make it slightly more populist because these people are reading different kinds of things. So if you want to get in the Daily Mail or even into The Sun, you're not going to get in a great discursive bit. You're going to get something relatively populist. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think, you know, what you're trying to do is communicate in a way that people want to read or hear what you're saying. And there's no point doing something very intellectual and pretending The Sun will run it, because they won't. But if you can get a little bit of science across in The Sun, I think that's a great achievement.
And the benefit of that is obvious. The snobbery that only people above a certain, you know, education level or income level can understand what's being said about things, or indeed can be interested about science, it's very common to make that argument. On the other hand, the downside, it would seem to me, of the compression that needs to occur if you're going to be in the sun, or the possibility of distortion, is that, A, what you're saying gets skewed, whether you're talking about no young people using Facebook anymore and discovering you've been misquoted, or then the other problem would seem to me that you run the risk of what maybe has happened to someone like Brian Cox. People say, well, he's a pretty face, he's on telly a lot, but I suspect he's not really a first-class scientist. Do you fear that the same could happen to you?
I don't know. I think I've been too long doing this kind of thing in public engagement to really worry too right. much about what my peers think. And I think people are generally very supportive. I think one of the advantages I have is I work at Salford. I work at a university which is not the highest profile university. So in general, my current VC and my senior management are delighted if I get publicity, provided it's not completely daft. And I work in a subject, acoustic engineering, which, you know, we spend time at the Institute of Acoustics discussing how do we get this branch of engineering visible, you know, as visible as, say, civil engineering is or electrical engineering. So I'm in a subject that kind of doesn't get talked about very much. So I think most of my peer groups, both in Salford and actually in acoustic engineering, I tend to be quite pleased that I'm trying to raise profile of the subject because it desperately needs doing.
Now, how do you find time for this plus research?
I think the key to anyone who's long in the tooth with a research career is getting those great researchers working with you on projects. And there's no real great time for me to do first-hand research. And in fact, one of the great things about doing Sonic Wonderland is I did get some chance to do some first-hand research. So, mm-hmm. you know, take, I don't know, Echo Bridge in Massachusetts, which is this yeah. bridge which has it's a big arch bridge, and underneath it's got an echo so distinctive they actually built a platform you can go down and stand on and try it out. And, you know, it was written about back in the 1940s in the academic literature saying, oh, what's going on here? And, of course, they didn't really have the techniques to easily test, whereas now I could get out some computer models and actually look at what was going on under that bridge. So actually, funnily enough, with Sonic Wonderland gave me a chance to get back to doing some little bits of first-hand research, which I think is really important as an academic to keep doing, keep your hand in a little bit. But I can't pretend that I do first-hand research very often. It's mostly working with others. In terms of time, I mean, huge amounts of work beyond the hours I probably should do is the reality in a long-suffering family.
I suppose that's common to a lot of academics. And if you have an opportunity at the same time to be engaging with school children, to be participating in Radio 4, citizen scientist competitions, it must be hard to turn down those opportunities, especially if you have the ideas, as was the case with So You Want to Be a Scientist.
Yeah, I think the hard ones are when people contact me. I mean, whenever I get in the papers, you get a few people talking about terrible noise problems they're suffering. Or, I mean, I had recently the University of Third, you know, U3A contact mm-hmm. me, say, can you do a lecture? And it's like, I said no. And they said, well, how about later in the year? And I can't honestly say my diary is full. And I have to sort of kind of be honest and say, I get loads of these requests and I just have to say no to most of them because I just haven't got the time. And actually, one of the things about universities now is that, you know, university finances are, you know, not in great states. And I've got to think carefully. I could fill my life easily just doing public engagement, but I still need to bring in the finances either via teaching or research or public engagement to justify my existence as a professor.
One of the things that the book focuses on is obviously that the hook is a certain kind of sound tourism, discovering, talking about research about some wonderful sounds around the world. And you mention people in Hong Kong talking about engagement, talking about endangered sounds, the fact that maybe the Teufelsberg ruins, essentially, in Germany that you investigate, the listening domes. Two of them are now ruined, and there's only one of the three left. And it would be nice if those could be kept. I mean, to what extent do you think it will ever be possible that certain sounds, or at least the things that produce the sounds, would have a hope of being listed in the way that buildings are for architecture?
Yeah, I mean, architects aren't going to list buildings because of their acoustics very often, because architects mm-hmm. are taught to think visually. So I wouldn't hold any great hope out. I guess some of the grand concert halls, like the Royal Festival Hall, is listed partly because it's a great concert venue in terms of, you know, its history and its place in acoustic science. But that would be the kind of exception rather than the rule. I mean, we are at least in an age where we could capture these places and preserve them. And, you know, we have amazing equipment here at Salford to reproduce virtually the acoustics of different places. So even if a place is getting destroyed, unfortunately, at least we could capture it before it disappears. And then at least we can recreate it at another date if we ever wanted to. So part of it might be about documenting rather than just trying to preserve where possible. Mm. You know, the acoustic environment is very much a sort of kind of accident, a lot of it. You mentioned the Teufelberg listening station, which is an old Cold War listening station. And there's a radar dome, which is up at the top, which gives you a spherical room to stand in, which has all sorts of weird effects in. And that just happens to be there. And as I said, I think chances are at some point it probably won't be anymore because everything else is getting sort of kind of gradually graffitied and damaged. And no one really takes much care of it, it seems. But, you know, maybe that's how life is. Things, you know, sort of do decay away. But we do need to capture these places and realise how special they are.
At one point in the book, you mentioned meeting up with some urban explorers for one of your wilder forays into the pursuit of sound. And it does seem to me that impetus, the desire on the part of urban explorers to go places where other people haven't gone or where they're not supposed to go or that other people might pass by without noticing, is also part of what makes these serendipitous sounds so fascinating in the book. And that must be part of your delight in them, that you can never be sure where wonderful sounds are going to turn up. Admittedly, most of us wouldn't want to climb down into an oil storage complex, or if I were you, I would have sent my postdoc. But is it the sense of delight and serendipity in part that makes these things so wonderful?
I think there is a delight in going to a place which visually is kind of not that wonderful and hearing something quite amazing to suddenly realise that there is something there beyond what we normally work with, which is our eyes. So I do think it's, you know, if I wander around Castlefield in Manchester, which is kind of the heart of the Industrial Revolution in many ways, there's all these wonderful brick arches of railway lines built as part of the Industrial Revolution, who have the most amazing acoustics here, and quite often are very smelly and obviously have tramps sleeping, not very far away quite often, or drunks. So I think there is a delight in having your, you know, kind of having that sort of expectation that this is just a dingy corner you want to avoid, sort of kind of subverted a bit. I think there's a joy in that.
It certainly seems that knowing that you should clap your hands to find out something about the acoustic properties of an area is one that I'm going to be picking up. It seems an astonishingly simple way to enjoy unusual acoustics.
Yeah, I think where it's particularly important is if you go to any ancient sites. And I would say, I'm getting a reputation of clapping everywhere. I do it very subtly and try not to disturb other people.
Except in the crypt of a church, I understand. You mentioned at one point getting ticked off by your family.
Yeah, it was only me and the family. I wouldn't have done it if someone was worshipping in the corner, but my wife was completely mortified, I can say. I think when you go to ancient sites, let's just say a stone circle, and if you are there on your own or you're just there with colleagues, it is important to remember that these sites were used for rituals, and it's very hard to think of a human ritual which doesn't involve sound in some way. I mean, occasionally there's kind of silent retreats, but mostly there is, you know, music and speaking and singing involved in any ritual. And so to not actually make any noise, but just to stand there and just look and go, oh, look, there's some stones in there standing up, and aren't they, you know, mustn't they have been difficult to get here, or I wonder why they're here, without actually kind of exploring the acoustics, is you're kind of missing a bit of a trick there. You're missing what might be one of the reasons they did it, was because it had interesting acoustics.
Obviously, people in your profession are much likelier to think about those things than the rest of us. We whip out our camera phones and take pictures or look at them, or perhaps comment on the smell, especially if there are unpleasant smells nearby. Does it ever surprise you at, although we live in a noisy world and music is important to a lot of us, that most of us are not tuned into exploiting that sense or thinking about that sense to the same degree as, say, visually?
Well, I just think it's how we are. I don't sort of kind of I don't lament it. I just kind of like to point out that there's other things to be enjoyed as well. So I see it as expanding horizons rather than sort of going, oh, you should be listening. If I could put it that way. I think people will increasingly capture sound. So when I look at people out with their phones at an event, which happens all the time now, most people seem to be capturing not pictures, but video. And of course, they're capturing sound on these things at the same time. Often the sound is captured is really poor quality. Go into that for other reasons.
Yes.
But, you know, if you go onto YouTube, it's full of videos of people's holiday destinations. And I mean, I've spent ages looking at them because if you want a site where someone says, oh, you should go here, the first thing you do is go on a video sharing site and see if anyone's videoed it. Because even if the recording's poor quality, you can get a sense of what's going on. And so I think people will increasingly more and more capture sound. And so I think, you know, yeah, in the old days, you used to come back from holiday and you used to show your photos around and it used to just be about what you saw. But I think more and more people are going to be showing videos or sharing videos. And then if the sound sounds awful, it's not very good, is it?
You mentioned you have searched for people's perception of the worst possible sound. If I'm not mistaken, looking at your Twitter timeline, the sound of vomiting was considered to be the worst by many, many people. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it's the disgust reaction. So we're kind of, as humans, we're trained to avoid stuff which might have disease, and obviously vomit is one of those. So I did a sort of quite an early online survey where people went and listened to sounds and rated them. It's quite early days, very early days of using sound across the internet for testing. And people were surprised that fingernails down the blackboard didn't come out to be terrible. I mean, it came pretty high up the list, but not worse. And I think that's because some people have a very strong response to fingernails down the blackboard, but others only a relatively weak response. I don't mind it. And therefore, it averages out to be not top of the list, whereas disgust seems to be a pretty universal reaction to avoid disease, and therefore everyone thought it was pretty horrible. It was also a particularly spectacular recording. It was really very unpleasant.
You say that with professional pride.
I didn't record it. It was recorded by Sarah Anglis, who does all sorts of interesting museum stuff and sound stuff. And, she and an actor did it. So I didn't actually record it. So I do know the technique, but I didn't.
You mentioned in the book as well that visual cues have often a lot to do with our interpretation of sounds, that you could play a recording to someone and in fact, the sound of waves on a beach or beach noises is often close to a sort of low rumble of traffic. So people's interpretation of what they think about that sound may draw on visual cues as well. So I'm wondering, does that mean we're relatively naive listeners or that we are not as attuned to just listening to the sound? And I wondered if maybe the vomiting being an awful sound is because you're not responding to it in an aesthetic way, or, you know, the pure sound, but just the association of what it is. It's as though our interpretation of what made a good painting would be only if someone was smiling in it, or if they were frowning in it, we would say that was a bad painting. Whereas, of course, most people's interpretation of what makes a good painting is a little bit more nuanced than that.
That's a really interesting analogy. I think certainly when you look at people responding to everyday sounds, the first thing we try and do is identify the source of it, because we react to what the sound is. And I think that's largely developed because hearing is primarily an early warning system, and we might think of it's about speech and about listening to music, but actually hearing is about warning for danger in evolutionary terms is its first use. And so if we want to know whether something's creeping up behind, we don't want to know, oh, that's a nice bassy creep. We just want to know there's danger behind us. So we have pretty short neural pathways to deal with sort of kind of threats from sound. And so when you get something like horrible or even pleasant, which is identifiable, we identify it, and then we respond to essentially to what the source is. We do have abstract stuff in sound, and I guess music is probably the best example. And music is a tremendous abstract art form. I suppose possibly not so if you're singing lyrics, where you've got the words as well. But actually, if you just take, let's say, classical music or any instrumental music, it is a very pure abstract art form. So there are examples of sounds we respond to purely because of the combination of the sounds and how that was, you know, how our brains either like or dislike it.
You also point out that, again, another thing that the book made me think about how good we are at listening is that humans are not so good at knowing what material an instrument is made out of. You talk about brassy notes and woody notes and so on, but it has more to do with the shape of a saxophone or another wind instrument than actually what it's made out of. And that, you know, noted jazz musicians used plastic saxophones at one point or another, and obviously the sound didn't have to do with the material. So again, is that a case that sound is much more basic a sense for us, or that we're more easily fooled than we are visually?
I think possibly more easily fooled because you can't see sound. So because sound propagates visibly through the air, that it's very difficult to tell what's causing sound and where it's going and what's happening. And I think that's some of the reason why, you know, people you get fooled by kind of sound effects. And I think a good example of that is musical instruments, that you can basically make quite a reasonable plastic clarinet. So you wouldn't play it professionally, but people would recognize it as a clarinet, as well as you can make one out of ebony, or you can make one out of brass. And they would all kind of, if people go, that's a clarinet, they might say, I prefer a particular one. They might prefer the wood one, because, of course, over the centuries, we've built an archetype up of that's what a clarinet should sound like. So no wonder the wooden one sounds kind of most clarinet-like. But they will all kind of be fairly similar in their characteristic. And so, you know, I think it's very easy for us then to go, well, why does the wooden one sound woody? Oh, it's because it's wood. And so I think it's very easy for us to make wrong associations.
That was certainly my explanation till I read this book.
Yeah, and many a bit of bad science audio gear is sold off the back of the same kind of deal. You know, I remember reading a particularly good magazine. I won't mention which one it was, which was discussing what the material of the shelf is you put your CD player on.
Of course.
And of course, a glass shelf. How do you think a glass shelf would make the CD sound?
Kind of glassy.
Clear, actually, but you're
clear.
And a wooden one would be warm, of course, and a metal one would be more brilliant. You know, it was that kind of thing. And it's very easy to make these associations. For one thing, we can, you know, psychologically, we convince ourselves things are going on which may not be true. So we buy an expensive widget for our hi-fi. Let's take a really good example is the really expensive leads you can get to connect up your mm-hmm. hi-fi system.
Mm-hmm.
You spend a lot of money on your hi-fi, you spend a lot of money on your leads, you're not going to plug them in and go, that made no difference. But if you do blind testing, you find there's no difference and they're not worth the money. But you've got so much invested in it, you'll think you'll hear a difference.
Well, as any record producer interacting with an A&R person knows, having been told to make something sound warmer or punchier and then being too cross to actually do it and playing it again to the person in question, having them say, yes, that sounds much better, thank you for having done it. I guess sound engineers realise more than anyone else how easy it is to fool people with something that has nothing to do with acoustics.
Yeah, I think this is where it plays into the book a bit here is also in when we look at archaeoacoustics, where people are looking at, you know, ancient archaeological sites, and were they designed? Were your standing mm-hmm. stones put up to sound acoustically wonderful? Well, I think you can make an argument about whether the acoustics would have changed very much if they moved the stones around. But I think for one thing, our ancestors wouldn't have had the knowledge to know whether it was making it better or for worse. and if they'd spent many months moving the stones, I'm sure they probably would have thought it was worthwhile at the end of it, whether it really was or not acoustically. Because we do this in modern day. We make changes and think, oh, that made all the difference. It's like, you know, and I don't think it's just acoustics. I mean, I think we might, redecorate a room and go, that's a much better colour. But deep down, we might not think it was.
There's a lot of psychology lurking behind this. I'm sure if I'd moved a few standing stones with a couple of friends and no wheels, I'd want to think it sounded better at the end as well.
Yeah, I mean, Stonehenge has got some amazing workings on the stones. The scientists have talked about whether the people have chipped them away to flatten them off to make the echo more strongly. And I don't know how many years of work it would have involved chipping these stones, but certainly there'd be no way they would have known at the end of it whether it made a difference or not, because they would have forgotten completely what it sounded like before.
I was astonished to hear about the replica of Stonehenge that you describe in the book and that it was actually valuable to carry out some of those tests. The American penchant for reproducing the wonders of the world.
Yeah, there's quite a few copies of Stonehenge made out of all sorts of things like cars and, as you can imagine, upended and with another car stuck on top. But there is actually a concrete replica of Maryhill, which is a replica of Stonehenge. And a colleague of mine, Bruno Fazenda, and a musicologist, Rupert Till, went across and made measurements. And all the time in acoustics, we make little models of things. So if you want to measure a concert hall, you can go into the concert hall, but if it doesn't exist, what do you do? Well, one thing you can do if you want to make measurements is to make a little dinky toy of it. You know, you scale everything by a 50th. You go up in 50 times the frequency, and you can do all the same stuff you do in the real space. And that enables you to kind of test things which don't exist yet or used to exist. So if I was going to test Stonehenge, you know, one thing you could do is build a replica physically, you know, make some little stones and make a little model scale.
A really small one. Would you get some people of restricted growth to dance around it at all?
Well, you make recordings with little miniature microphones and then you sort of scale it back up to full scale. But, you know, we didn't have to make a scale model of Stonehenge because the Americans have built a World War One memorial, which is an entire replica of Stonehenge or one of its configurations, because, of course, it had lots of configurations. So it's much easier just to fly across and measure that.
One of the things that I enjoyed most about the book was that, of course, all academics cite each other's work, important papers, refer back to great names of the past or to contemporary peers who are doing important work. And we know how those appear in scholarly papers as footnotes, as citations. It seemed like this book was a wonderful opportunity to point out some great and interesting work being done, certainly in the past, but also now. So it gave you an opportunity to give a shout out to other people working in the field who are doing interesting things. It seems very generous.
Oh, that's very kind. I was one of the things which felt really privileged doing the book was an excuse to ring up someone and say, you know, you're doing this work on bubbles. Can you explain to me this? And, you know, not only a privilege to be able to go very broadly over a subject area rather than be very narrow in my little bit of acoustics that I work in, but also a real privilege just to, you know, ring up a real expert. Mark Down, who does the work on bats down in Bristol. You know, I don't do anything to do with bat acoustics. I'll never will probably do anything to do with bat acoustics, but there I got to speak to a world-leading expert. So one of the great things about doing public engagement is you do have an excuse to say, I'm writing a book, would you mind? And people are really generous with their time.
What about the BBC? It's certainly, there's one fantastic, very passing reference on page 219, one of the loveliest deadpan bits in the book. One day at the office, that is, our anechoic chamber at Salford University, as the BBC tried to measure the footfall of a centipede. Now, Trevor, is our licence fee going to this sort of thing?
Actually, I would strongly recommend you looking up that video because it is the most marvellous video to show what an anechoic chamber does. I don't know, is it licence fee? Well, it was part of Bango's
theory. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it was great. They're trying to illustrate how quiet it is, and of course you can't play silence across the television because it wouldn't be silent in people's living rooms.
Yes.
So they got Chris Watson, who's this great natural history recordist, along and got him to try and record lots of quiet things. Like, I think they had that little pot of maggots which were moving around. They sound like a bit like Rice Krispies. I think it says in the video. And then they tried to get a centipede. And they tried to record a snail crawling along. I think the snail they couldn't record; it was too quiet. And it was just a really, really fun piece of VT. And the great thing for me, from my point of view, again, publicising my subject area, is that, you know, it's great to see acoustic engineering on, you know, BBC One in prime time.
Absolutely. Were you ever tempted to move over to work in industry full time? Obviously, you've taken on some enormously important commissions and your engagement is not just public engagement, but also that university industry engagement. Hasn't anyone ever tried to lure you away to become a hotshot venue fixer, flying around the world and walking in and waving your hands at something and saying, fix it?
I worked for 10 years for a big manufacturer of products just on, you know, as a consultant alongside being an academic. And as an engineer, that was really valuable because I can actually, you know, not only have I got lots of research papers, but I can show you lots of pictures of rooms where my actual, you know, my research has ended up being used, which I think if you're working in an engineering field, you, you really should have something which ends up being used somewhere, really, whether it's a prediction model or whether it's a, you know, actually physical an item in the end which gets put into the world. So I'd got a lot of industrial experience, and then I went into public engagement and did lots and lots of public engagement work. And I think the thing is, I've got all my teaching commitments, I've got all my research to keep going. There's not time to do teaching, research, public engagement, and industrial work. So I actually gave up my industrial work to do public engagement because I just didn't have time to do it all. And as into going to work industry, I think there's lots of problems in academia, and we all like to sit around the coffee table and have a moan about how terrible it is. But actually, it's a real privilege to be able to choose what you want to do. I mean, within constraints. I mean, in industry, would I have had a chance to go off and fly around the world and go and listen to sites and write a book? No, but I can blag a bit of time and a bit of equipment here and there to do it in my spare time as well. I'm an academic.
Do you still have time to play the saxophone?
Yes, I play every day if I get a chance, except I do find on the days at end of lectures I'm just so knackered I just can't play very well. But yes, no, I took the saxophone up when my children started playing music. I'd originally played instruments as a child, and one of the most interesting things is, despite taking a break of 15 years, a lot of the neural pathways still existed, which kind of surprised me.
There's hope for all of us who gave up our piano lessons when we were young then. Obviously, a lot of venues, conventional and unconventional, get mentioned in the book, and I'm sure as a Mancunian and as a musician, you have some favourites. Bridgewater Hall is mentioned with great affection, and I wondered if you had any thoughts about the venues that sound loveliest to you as a music listener, even rather than as a professor of acoustic engineering. Have you any favourites?
Well, I certainly say when I go to a concert hall for a concert, I go to listen to the concert. I don't go to listen to the hall primarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to there was a big conference that I helped organise down at the Royal Albert Hall near where the Proms was on. Mm-hmm. Went to a prom, and so many people came out going, oh, you know, the coast, it's the Albert Hall, blah, de blah. And I go, oh, I quite enjoyed it, really. You know, it's about listening to me and enjoying. I think if I was going to pick a venue, I think my favourite concert hall and favourite concert was actually hearing Shostakovich in the Waterfront Hall in Belfast. And that was probably just as much down to the great orchestra which was playing as to the very good acoustics.
Lovely. Thank you so much for joining us, Trevor.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.